My name's Anita Zima, and I am with the Interchange Bench, which is the proud sponsor of Don't Shoot the Messenger. Kirsten Pilati is here as the CEO of BCNA, and it's my great privilege that not only did 100 people donate $100, which makes $10,000, but a whole lot of you donated even more. So today it's my pleasure to hand over a cheque for $12,250. Now I'm delighted to hand over to who you're all waiting to hear from, and that's Caroline Wilson and Corey Perkin.
Thank you so much, Anita, and thank you to the Interchange Bench for all you've done for this event, and again, the Inge family and the wonderful Croc Media. I just want to thank the person who, well, you and I thought up the idea of doing a podcast over a game of Scrabble with our girls a few summers ago, but it was two footy seasons ago, Craig Hutchison and I, who people think we don't really like each other, but we drive home together every Monday night, and one night, we're on the drive home. Craig said, I think you should do a podcast. And I said, funny you should say that, Craig, because I've got the perfect person to do it with. And he loved the idea. And he's followed through. He's here today. And he's going to join us for 1 minute. Come on, Craig, up on stage. What a bonus getting Craig here. Craig's had enormous success with his own podcast. He runs a multi-million dollar international media business, but the best fun he has is when he sits down with his friend Damien Barrett. Their last show for the year has just gone to air. But Craig, you're going to give us your GLT, and what everyone wants to know is who is going to win the premiership next year.
Well, first of all, welcome to everyone. Just going to echo, I know we've got to get on with things, but to the host, to the Interchange Bench, who have been an unbelievable advocate and supporter of this, and the way they interconnect, even events like today, is a great credit to them and the way they leverage the relationship. So thanks and welcome to you guys. And to the venue, this is iconic, this venue. This is the GLT, this venue. It's the last of the great suburban pubs.
We're not at an AFL meeting now. Leverage and iconic. And not words we need to use.
Righto, you've got no microphone for a moment. I'm sure you'll be okay. And this is fantastic to see everyone here today. Caro makes fun of me for never being able to hold down a relationship in 25 years, but my partner and her 10 best friends are addicted to this podcast series and every element of it. So I feel like you're kind of keeping me in a relationship via this product at the moment. So thank you to both of you for that. And tip for the flag, I think, like everyone, I'm a bit caught up in the Essendon movement at the moment. I think they'll be a very good team next year. And I think Ben Rutten from Richmond will be their biggest off-field recruit, and they'll be hard to beat. So thanks again for coming today, and to the BCNA team, well done on everything you do. It's magnificent, and everyone's really proud to be a small part of your journey today, and thanks for joining us.
Okay, let's get down to business. Welcome, everybody, to episode 64 of Don't Shoot the Messenger. It's our first live show. I'm here with my dear friend, the bookseller and journalist extraordinaire, Corey Perkin.
Hi,
I'm
Caroline Wilson. Everyone.
It is so lovely to put faces to all the people who've been sending us such lovely feedback over the last year and a half. We have two special guests to kick off, Andrew Rule, the Walkley Award-winning journalist and author, the man who invented Underbelly. Well, we can say it because Sly's
I think
not here.
Probably Sly would.
And Andrew's former colleague, another award-winning author, publisher extraordinaire, and a great friend of the podcast, Jeff Slattery.
What have I won?
Well, you helped us win a few awards, so we'll give you the credit for that. Now, I'm going to kick off. I'm going to ask the three of you a question because you three, Andrew Rule, Jeff Slattery, and Corey Perkin, all met in the Age Sports Department.
Yep.
I think that's where your friendship began, circa 1981.
No, I actually met Andrew the day I started at the Age.
Yes.
Okay. But I want to hear about what it was like working together in that sports department because names, well, the three of you, and there was Mike Coward, and there was Neil Mitchell, and there was Ron Carter.
Ron Carter. I learned something from Ron.
What did you learn?
He turned around and he said to me, Andy, he knew I could spell. He said, how do you spell greyhound? And before I could say anything, like EY, he said, doesn't matter, dog. That was Ronnie.
What was it like working with Australia's first woman football writer, Jeff?
Well, aha, can everybody take note of that, please?
Corey, I always give you the credit. Well, I do.
It was a bit different from this event here, where I think I can see two men. It was more like all the women were men and then there was Corrie.
Yep.
But I'm getting old and I don't remember working with Corrie in the sports department.
I do.
You bloody idiot. You just so. Don't you remember you were, Neil Mitchell, our sports editor, said you better take her to the first game to show her the ropes, and you and I went to see Melbourne v Hawthorn at the MCG, and Lee Matthews said to you, mate, get the girl out of here. And I had to leave the dressing rooms.
You made that up.
No, it's not true. I remember that story.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Because Corrie told you the story. That's what you remember. What I do remember from my time at the Age with Corrie was that in those days when we were a bit more slack in the editing department, she had a byline called Corny Parkins rather than Corrie Perkin. So from now on, whenever I speak to her on the telephone, hello, Corny.
Didn't someone write a letter of complaint about that sports journalist Corny Parsu?
Corny Parsu.
Anyway, you've gone back to your roots, Andrew. Sports writing.
Yes.
And you've...
I wonder where this is... I didn't know we were working blue.
And you've written a... We certainly are not. You've written a book about Australia's greatest racehorse.
I have.
I think she's probably past Black Caviar now and a few others. And...
I'll go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that. It's called Winx. Pretty definitive title. I've heard you do a lot of interviews promoting this book. It's a wonderful book and we know what a beautiful writer you are. But... How difficult was it? Because obviously you're not going to interview a racehorse, and the story everybody.
How do you know?
Everybody's read so much about Winx. Tell us how it came about.
You had to do it better. Really, it's the story of the people behind the horse. She's a lousy interview subject, even for a horse. She's not very charismatic, I have to say. She's a plain bay mare. If you saw her in a paddock with 10 other plain bay mares, you'd be flat out picking her.
Can I just jump in there and say, when I went to the last Cox Plate, and thanks to certain connections in the family, in the owners, in the mounting yard and everything, I thought exactly the same thing. She's not an attractive horse like Black Caviar is.
That's a fair comment. She's attractive in her own way.
Yeah.
But we all are, Corrie.
That's true, Andy, that's true.
Some more than others. But I've never been accused of it myself. But look, she isn't the charismatic animal that some would want her to be, but she's just phenomenally good. She's the horse that God built for galloping. She's got whatever, that subtle thing that makes one stand out from 100,000 others.
When Ross Stevenson launched the book, he called your work a jigsaw, which brought together all the components of the story.
Yeah.
And having read it, it's quite remarkable the lengths you went to put those jigsaw pieces together, from the deep south of New Zealand to the Hunter Valley and all places in between. How difficult was it to actually get the those involved to actually communicate freely and frankly with you?
Some better than others, but the toughest one was the breeder, John Camilleri, very wealthy man. He's a poultry tycoon in Sydney. He's the guy that bred Winx and sold her, so he's sort of a little bit wounded because his kids say to him, Dad, how come we bred the best horse in the world and sold her for 200 grand, you idiot? And
fair,
I think,
fair enough.
I think, it makes him sad at times, but probably at 4 in the morning, he doesn't love it. But he says, I do still own her mother, which is good. He was hard to get across the line with, but once he embraced it, was good. The rest were pretty good. They're tight for time. I have to say, Chris Waller is probably, and I mean this, he's probably busier than the Prime Minister. He gets up at 3:02 every morning. He goes straight to the stables. He knocks off at 6 p.m. and drives home, turns the phone off. He's a very hard man to talk to, and generally I would talk to him while he was driving home on his mobile phone.
Yeah, well, the other thing about the book is that it should teach us all not to get involved with racehorses, because the luck of the draw is quite incredible. From the covering of the grandmother in the South Island by a guy who won 25 grand or 30 grand at the races off a $5 ticket.
Well, you may recall, Slats, that, Graham Rogerson sends a couple of cheap mares to his own cheap stallion called Batavian, standing on a cheap former cattle stud in the North Island. And the guy that's running the stud rings Graham Rogerson, says, I've got good news and bad news. And he said, what is it? And he said, well, the bad news is your horse, Batavian, had a heart attack serving a mare this morning, and therefore...
Like Billy Snedden.
Like Billy Snedden. Exactly
never
right.
Never confirmed.
But not with the same person.
Hang on.
Different.
That gives us
different co-respondents, lads.
That gives us an opportunity to go to the truth headline. So Billy died on the job.
He did.
I was waiting for that.
He did. And that's a true story. Apologies to any Snedden relatives.
Let him go. Let him go through the story.
Yes, go
so,
on.
He said, yeah, that's the bad news. My horse died. And he said, the good news is I've got another stallion here called El Akbar, even more humble than yours, Graham, and I'll get her in foal to that one. And he said, oh, all right. And that's how they bred Winx's mother, who was a ripper. And,
gosh.
And it was a total chance, a heart attack on a cattle farm in New Zealand.
Andy, how did she get her name?
We've got to clean this up a bit.
Oh, don't. Oh. No, we can talk blue here.
We can't,
come on,
talk, we
girls.
Can't talk blue. The old chap, there's three owners, and the oldest one is a lovely old gentleman called Richard Treweek, who's one of an old sort of grazing dynasty, raced horses all his life, been a bit of a playboy in his time, Corey, bit of a James Bond type.
Don't look at me when you say that.
No, just saying. I'm sort of talking to you. And Richard has named all his... He generally races mares and he gives them sort of cheeky names. There's Champagne Cath and Ruth's Secret, and that's something about an affair he had with a woman called Ruth, apparently. His daughter assures me that he had 17 women at his 80th birthday and they all told her that they knew him biblically. So that gives you some insight into Richard Treweek. He's a charming, charming old gent. And he said, well, this mare, this filly is out of Vegas Showgirl, and those Vegas Showgirls, when you see them dancing, they wink at you.
There you go.
Did you clean that up or is
it? A bit.
I think you need a bit of an imagination.
I'm using my imagination. Yeah, yeah.
We don't need to go into this.
So Andy, obviously sports writing was your forte. You went into radio production. You produced Ross and John for many years. You went back into writing, won Walkley Awards. Some of your groundbreaking crime stories actually brought to justice some terrible people.
Yeah.
And now you're back writing about sport. But I want to ask you about Underbelly.
Yes.
Because it's become a franchise.
It has.
That you and your great friend John Sylvester began. Tell us about how it started and where it is now.
I have to give credit to John. The word Underbelly is John's idea because he, as he says, he's like the queen bee in the hive. He just give him royal jelly and he rolls out. He doesn't do much, but he rolls out. He rolls out a good idea. And then I'd do the work. Nah. And I'd fix the spelling, the grammar.
How many books?
Maybe 18 or 20. Lots.
Wow. Ruler, that's at least a renovation on your house. So I remember you saying after the first one, yep, it's put on the new kitchen.
Yeah, and then we had the chopper wing.
Yes.
It's a true story, yes. And in fact, I think there was a TV series where they had a character called Slasher and somebody made a reference to the Slasher wing, a direct rip-off of my chopper wing.
Oh.
Inspired.
What about the downside of publishing crime books?
That they all get shoplifted?
Well, no. there's good news and bad news, lads. Because they all get shoplifted, the shopkeepers used to put them up on the counter where they could see them and then the punters would come in and see them right there and buy them. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think I was referring to the issues to do with law and defamation.
Oh, that's not good, no. Have we got any lawyers here? Can you leave, please? People say to me, you must be it must be dangerous doing all that stuff. I go, not really. It's the legal actions that have made sure that I've still got a mortgage at my age because we've been sued and sued and sued until our noses bled.
Apart from the breeder, were there any other big stumbling blocks?
Wallace, a hard man to talk to because he's intense. He's very sane, but he's extremely intense and extremely busy, and he doesn't really have a lot of time to spare, so he was hard. The Bowman family were great. Huey Bowman's a really good guy, and his parents are just diamonds. They're fascinating people. The Wallace family were good back in New Zealand. They're really nice old farming folk, horse people, but farmers. There's a difference. New Zealand horse people tend on average to be sort of farmers and offshoots of farming, Australians might tend to be more spivs.
I was going to say that. I mean, the Australian racing industry has not really got the reputation it would want to have at the moment. And
not all altogether.
No. Where do you see it?
Where do I see it? Yeah. Oh, that's a long answer. But I'll cut it short. I think it's got its problems, and I think historically it's got problems because I think it's – in America, we can see it already, it's more a niche sport in America, and we're going to slowly see it become a niche sport here unless something is done about it. It's very like newspapers, Caro.
Yeah, but at the same time, you look at the race book, there's 30 owners or 50 owners, which is an innovation that comes from this country,
yes,
which gives mugs like us to have the opportunity to race a horse unless you read this book and decided it was too hard to be lucky.
Well, you mean just because there's one winks in 20,000 foals and only one winks every generation. That's right.
Tell me, if it hadn't have been authorised, would you have taken on the task to actually write a biography of a horse?
No, I was commissioned by the people behind Winks. They wanted, the publishers came to me and said, look, the Winks owners and so on, and Hugh Bowman are keen on doing a book or whatever, or I've agreed to do a book, but we need someone who can write it well. So they came to me, really probably as a rescue mission, I think.
Was that before you Kerry Stokes' book last year or the year before or after?
Since then, yeah.
But they'd
seen the Stokes' book was the entree card.
I was going to say, that was a pretty good book.
Yeah. And
that's not authorised.
Yeah. It was.
No, was it? Yeah.
It was, but you couldn't tell Kerry because so honest.
No, well, I'm actually surprised to hear that. Style. Because you found out things about Kerry Stokes that he wouldn't have wanted people to find out.
A little bit of that, and probably things he didn't know himself in some respects.
So. Yeah, exactly.
It was good. It was
Slats, can I ask you, as Andrew's former colleague and editor and good friend, what is it about Andy's style that makes him such a great sports writer? Because when you and I first started on the same day at the age in 1979...
When I was 12...
You're a boy from the country, and you really did talk about sports reporting with great affection. It was kind of like the thing that you wanted to do. But what was it about Andrew's style that works?
Well, I wouldn't claim him as a sports writer. I just claim him as a diligent reporter, and that's been the same from the get-go. He sat a couple of desks in front of me, I think next to Peg McMahon or thereabouts. Yeah. Is that right? Am I memory going okay?
Probably.
Yeah.
Behind Ronnie Carter.
A quiet observer of what was going on around him. One who, like me, was fortunate to be in an environment with some great people who did great things and were mentors to all of us. So in that environment, you never fail to pick up the processes that make journalism work, which is hard work, lots of phone calls, lots of rewrites of your first three or four paragraphs, communication with others, have I got it right, good editing, all those sort of things. And that's what he's kept through over, what are we up to now, mate, 40 years?
40 years. I don't think I've ever worked with a better group of people without pissing in your pocket and telling you it's champagne.
No, Dennis Pagan said... Don't tell me. Hang on.
He didn't say that.
What?
He said, "Don't wee on my back."
And don't piss on my back and tell me it's raining, son.
Yeah. Well, it was a great bunch.
Goes to the line. Another one. He said, "You can't go down Lygon Street and find a shop called Confidence." That was the Carlton type. Well, but you do pick up from all these people, don't you? And they were all so generous and involved in what you did, and it was not me against you, it was us, you know.
Well, Corey and I learnt from the older reporters, such as yourself. I remember... I'm slightly older, not much older.
Before you decided to enter the food industry.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember you writing a piece about Lou Richards and about Jack Dyer, which at the time were landmark features. You know, later on, everybody tried to write like that, but you did it first. And I used to copy it.
I remember the first paragraph of that Lou story.
Yeah, yeah.
It was in his apartment building in Toorak Road.
Sir, yeah, a suddenly serious... Is that how it goes?
Don't shit-can me, Jeff. Don't shit-can me. So Lou had an amazing inferiority complex that whenever he did anything, and it's hard to believe, we were such a performer, how did I go? How was that? Was that good? Don't shit-can me, Jeff. Don't shit-can me.
Yeah. Well, Wilma, who won our lucky door prize today, I picked number 17 because, as my mother will tell you, a good local tip
Michael
is all...
Tuck.
Ooh, Jack Dyer.
Jack Dyer.
And it's a famous Richmond number, and you... I remember you, that was your most groundbreaking piece, was the Jack Dyer piece that ran for... It would never be allowed these days. How many words was that? It would have been about 20,000 words.
It was when the Age had space on a Saturday. It was a Saturday extra.
The good local tip is always put 17 in your Tatts Lotto numbers. It always gets up, doesn't it, Mum?
Okay. Yep, yep. So next time we're going to buy a horse, Andy, we're going to get
rubbish.
Lot
it's
17.
True.
We will.
It's true.
Lot 117. Yeah. Lot 217. Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Jack Dyer was fantastic. If you walked down the street with Jack, anybody he met, he'd say, "Hello, are you well?" "Hello, are you well?" And in that story, I remember I did a transcript of the 1978 grand final. And the ball goes down on the wing and dip it, dip it, dip it, dip it. Domenico's picked it up, he's kicked it long to the square, and in they come and up they go. And the umpire handballs to Hendry. Jack was a classic.
He was a beauty.
Thanks, Jeff, for the Jeff Slattery show there.
Oh, sorry. and thanks for putting 1 o'clock on the running sheet too, by the way.
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. I realised I gave you the wrong time. We are selling this book down the back, by the way, and Andrew will be available, from lunchtime on, if you'd like it signed. That's the only plug for the book, but really it is fantastic. Andy, what would you have done if she hadn't won the Cox Plate the other day?
I was worried when they announced a statue a few days before the Cox Plate.
Yes, yes. I was worried until they jumped, and as soon as they jumped and she jumped on terms, I said, she's it's home and host. But I was worried because...
But, you know, in the mounting yard, what I loved is a Debbie, the lovely owner who always wears the lavender colour.
Yes.
So this is a very sort of secluded place, and as I said, I was there swinging on the coattails of son Will, who works for Godolphin, and the horses come into this quiet space and the owners are actually in the middle. And there's a whole group of people quietly sitting like you all are now, and all of a sudden the chant started... Debbie, Debbie, Debbie. And 200 people, she burst into tears and anyway went over to a whole group of them, and the people were wanting selfies with her, and it was just such a lovely, they're such honest owners, and it was such a lovely thing to see. Of course, Coco, who came with me, we started crying, and I don't think when the race finished, oh, I can't begin to tell you what a privilege it was to see that racehorse up close and personal.
It's highly emotional.
You got to pat her and got to know her quite well.
A little bit. But Debbie, I thought Debbie could be...
No, not Debbie, not Debbie.
I thought Debbie...
The horse, you idiot.
Oh, sorry.
What about... Kara gets asked often by publishers, would she do her memoir? And she keeps saying, no. Would you publish Caroline Wilson's memoir?
I would not.
That's putting you on the spot.
Depends if it told all the true stories.
I think there's definitely a place for the memoir of quality sports writers or people that have been strong in the world of journalism. I'm not sure that Kara would have 880 pages like Kerry O'Brien, but you might.
I certainly would not.
You want to write a novel anyway.
I don't want to write about myself. You commissioned that Yellow and Black book.
Yeah.
They canned it because Richmond had such a terrible season in 2016.
Yeah.
You got them to agree to the book come what may. Conrad Marshall embedded himself again in the Richmond Football Club. Unbeknownst to the greatest result you could ever have wished for, they won a flag. And then now you want to do a second book or a after forward? Because this year he went back, didn't he?
Yeah, you
thought they'd win another flag.
Well... We had an agreement with Richmond to go back inside the club from round 23 to actually describe any changes that may have happened and any different methods that they may have to approach the grand final. But the relationship was one in which the Tigers had to get to the grand final. So after the second week of the finals...
Preliminary final,
done.
Third week.
Well, look, I know it's dear for you. I know.
It's time
to move
on, Carol.
I would have thought you would have known the structure of the final series. But weren't you going to try and get them to change their mind because that loss was, in a way, an even better story? Or
no, not really.
Story?
No, I think there had to be... I think books like this need to have a success to them. I don't think we need doom and gloom. And that would have been doom and gloom for the people
I certainly
of the Tigerland.
Now,
we have to move on now.
I think you're going to stick around and maybe join us after lunch, because my mother, Julia, has a few bones to pick with you about recipes. Anna from the op shop and you, who kindly filled in for me a few weeks ago, are going to get together as well.
Good, so that's good timing, because the running sheet says 1 o'clock for me, Cara, which is why I rolled up late.
So you're here anyway.
Yeah.
We've got, as I said, we've got all our regular segments coming up. GLTs, Crush of the Week. I'm very grumpy about something, Corrie, and for once we agree on this one.
You're always grumpy. You're always grumpy with me.
Every week when we get together to plan this podcast, Corrie says, I've got a grumpy. In fact, I've got several grumpies. You're always the grumpy one.
I'm very grumpy. I could talk about being grumpy about moving house this week. Gosh, that's fun, the day before a live podcast. But I just really want to say thank you to my dear friend, Andrew Rule. I hope you all get to meet him and go and buy, 10 or 20 of the books, and he can then have a don't shoot the messenger wing on his big mansion in Templestowe. But Andy, thanks for coming. We really appreciate it, and all the best with the book.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And for our listeners who know that Caro and I have a bit of a thing for 1970s recipes, our darling friends at the Flying Duck are about to serve you chicken in the basket, just so you can remember when. If your business needs new players, pick them up from the Interchange Bench, the leading provider of temporary and contract talent. As I said earlier, interchangebench.com.au. Coco, who's out the back, my daughter, selling books, she has had a fabulous experience doing some interchange work. And as we always say, for talent so good, you wish you could keep them. Now, Caro, you're grumpy, but before you go on to grumpy, I just want to say moving house sucks. I learn a new tip every time. I've done 6 moves in 10 years. So what I've learned is I have way too many lipsticks. I obviously have an obsession. Also, for some reason...
This is how mean Corrie gets when she moves. Me and her great friend Jane McCubbin, both turned up the other night with bottles of beautiful champagne, and she said, look at you two competing over your champagne. I mean, how ungracious is that? Jane, you're here somewhere.
It was very embarrassing. I was that pissed off.
Jane did a few of these behind Corrie's back.
The other thing I noticed too is that, when men give you, usually your partner, husband, boyfriend or whatever, they think, oh, I'm going to buy her some sexy underwear. So I looked, as I'm going through all the drawers of stuff, I look at all these, pairs of really lacy knickers that have never been worn, just thinking, what was he thinking? I am not size 8 and want to wear a G-string. It was time to throw them out, okay? So back to Bonds for me. So too many undies. Caro, what are you grumpy about today?
Corrie, I know this is not original, and I know, I'm sure you'll agree with me. Black Friday to Victorians was the day of the worst bushfires, one of the worst bushfires the world has ever seen. It was January 1939. More than 70 people died. Entire towns were wiped out. And there was a royal commission into those bushfires that led to major changes in the way we run our forestry. Black Friday is not a day of sales after Thanksgiving. That is for Americans.
And it's not even on a Friday.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
as Anna said, not even on a Friday, goes all weekend. And can I just tell you, as a local trader in a shop, it kills business. It absolutely kills business. All last week, our figures were down. So were all the dress shops, the shoe shops. It really is. It's not just even shop local. It's just an American affectation.
It's great for Americans. It's when companies go from the red into the black, and it's a completely different thing. But for us, Black Friday has a different meaning, and I am sick of my emails being bombarded with Black Friday promotions.
And you're not watching any Hollywood movies either from now on?
What does that mean? No.
Well, it's an American importation. Oh.
You've never forgiven me for that Coen Brothers movie I sent you to 20 years ago and you hated. I'm grumpy about Black Friday, but now it's time to get our guests involved because it's time for BSF, Books, Screen, Food. And, Mum, you have several books you want to talk about.
Yes, I do, but first I want to start off by saying when Caro and Corrie started this quite soon early on, they said, we think we'll ask Anna on. I said, don't. She'll be... better than either of you. What a mistake. And I think I've been right. And I want to say, too, not only is Anna funny, but her sister, she of the wet cement slice, and her mother are two of the funniest people you could ever meet. So one day, perhaps Caro will have them all together.
It's not a competition, Mum. We celebrate our friends.
I think your mum's right. I think Anna's way funnier than you and I.
Oh, well,
no pressure.
No question about that. But, Mum, you want to talk... You brought a book with you. We're trying to... What we want to do today is not tell you necessarily about things that have just come out, but comfort reading, comfort watching and comfort eating over the festive season.
Well, do you want to start with books or films? I don't do recipes anymore, especially
Jewel,
not
for
slats here.
Jewel, let's do a book. You do a couple of Chrissy books or comfort reading books, and then I'll tell everybody about my aptly named Christmas Pudding by Nancy Mitford.
Julia, what about the brains and walnut sandwiches for the races?
Oh, yeah, I'm too old to go to the races and it's too hard to buy brains.
Not many brains on this table.
No.
Jeff?
Oh, ha-ha.
Well, I will talk about books at Christmas, Caro told me to do. Well, the first thing is, before you do anything, sort out what you've already got. And I'm weeding through old thrillers, and a lot of them I've saved for years by some of the great names, and they turn out to be absolute tosh now. But others are better than ever, and so go to an op shop near you, and you can always get some good thrillers of the great golden age of the dames.
If you're not going to Corrie's bookshop.
Oh, no, I'm going to that.
No, I'm happy with the op shop recommendation, Caro, because the other day I visited the Sacred Heart Mission and visited Anna, and I was very impressed by your book section. You didn't colour coordinate, which was a bit upsetting for me.
Oh.
However, it's beautifully curated.
Mum started on the colour coordinate.
We tried to colour coordinate. Customers jacked up completely. We had to go back to the alphabetical.
But Corrie is selling a wonderful book that everybody of, you know, perhaps over 70 will want to buy. It's called Australia or the World Before Avocados. Yeah. And it's absolutely hysterical. And it suits everyone of my age. If you've got a great aunt or something to buy for, buy that.
It's and by then, Richard Glover.
Yeah, yes, and I've bought a favourite book of mine, which is so the 1950s. Time of the coronation and all that carry on. And it's called Mother Stayed at Home. And it's a woman who lives on the beach at Collaroy. And where we go to coffee shops to meet our friends, they went to the beach every morning and sat there and did the local gossip. And it's partly her diaries and it's partly the letters she got from her travelling daughter who stayed up all night in the street to see the coronation. But it's absolutely a book of rare charm and absolutely one of the funniest books you could ever read. I don't know where you'd ever get it, because I've had it for 40 years.
Julia, I'm
but
not,
it's lovely.
I'm not familiar with the term coronation. Of what do we speak?
Oh, boo. Don't be. Everybody's fallen in love with the crown.
Oh, pig's ass.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Slats.
That was a bit of John Elliott just brought to the podcast.
Corrie, I'm just going to quickly name two bits of comfort reading because I brought them along. The film's good, but the book's even better. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
That's actually a really lovely hardcover edition. I must get that back in the shop.
But it's a remake of a book printed in the 60s.
Yeah, don't get Mum started again. Mum feels it was rather ripped off, but she's honest about that in the preview, about why she did it.
Well, don't do it, I say.
Now, if you really want some really good trash this summer on the beach, you can't go past Rosamund Pilcher. You can buy her at Corrie's shop. You can buy her at any op shop. My favourite is Coming Home. Probably her most famous one is The Shell Seekers. But this is a trilogy. Seriously, anyone who wants to borrow it today, it's got The Day of the Storm, Another View and Sleeping Tiger. It is just days and days of happy escapism.
Well, when you mentioned her last year on the podcast, I realised I had to get some in of her because people were coming in saying, do you have Rosemary?
No, I thought the homework was Christmas, you know, a favourite Christmas book. So I was thinking, you know, Charles Dickens, Hans Christian Andersen, but I've actually gone with Dr. Seuss, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, because it's such a gorgeous book for children, adults, good message. It's not all about the presents.
The and Mum's sister, Mum has two sisters. Mum wants to start her own podcast now called The Knowles.
They want to.
Anyway, we caught up with Mum's middle sister, Button, and her daughter, Georgie, the other day.
Her name's not really Button. Can we just say that?
Well, everyone calls her Button. She is urging everybody to read Elizabeth is Missing by Emma Healy. And Georgie just says, it's less than $5, my purple-scented novel, which is Ian McEwan's 70th birthday present to himself.
Oh, okay.
It's about 40 or 50 pages, and apparently it's a bit of a literary mystery, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Okay. I haven't heard of it.
Well, I think it's about to come out.
Can we go on to screen now, or do we have any more books?
No,
Joel, do you have a nice thing that you like to watch at Christmas time or any time?
Oh, yes. Well, Caro said good things at Christmas. Well, I just did the classic movie that makes everybody feel better, Meet Me in St. Louis.
That was mine.
Oh, well, I'll talk.
No, you talk, because you introduced it to me.
Well, I got your book out yesterday. I went to your bookshelves while you were still at Anglesey and I read the critique of Margaret O'Brien as a film star, and it's so true. The great James Aggie wrote of a glimpse of her achievement hypnotised me as thoroughly as anything since Garbo. And that opening scene where she's on the Iceman's cart and the Iceman says, "How's your doll?" and Margaret O'Brien says, "She's got four types of fatal disease." It's just sweet. And the other one is, Children.
No, you can do it because love that more than
And
anything.
The other one that we always watched at the beach when my children were young, I don't know why, it's not Christmassy, but it came out every January, The List of Adrian Messenger.
Oh, yeah, that's a great
We all loved it, young and old. Can't think why. It wasn't a great movie, but it was a sort of spoof movie.
It was a mystery, okay. And all these famous film stars acted in disguise.
They wore wax masks,
like that,
and they pulled them off at the end.
After the end sign, people like Tony Curtis and George C. Scott, who also played himself.
And Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra.
Burt Lancaster.
Incredible. It's a great film.
Anna, do you have a screen?
I do. One of my all-time favourites, Love Actually.
Oh.
And not just for Christmas. It's got a fantastic cast, brilliant director in Richard Curtis, best soundtrack. I don't know if you've ever got onto that. It's brilliant. And every time I watch it, I fall in love with yet another of the couples or the scenarios. But I always cry hysterically when Emma Thompson is sitting on the bed when she realises her husband's having the affair to Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. I'm nearly crying now. It's just... I saw it on my own. I howled in the cinema
But also when she says to him, when they've watched the Christmas play and she's put on the happy face and everything and then, you know, mentions the gift that she didn't receive and what would you do? And Alan Rickman just goes, you know, I am a klutz. Mm. And she, you know, she just so magically just says, you've made a mockery of my life. And then something about the child's dress is something.
Yeah.
And
she's interrupted.
Oh, you looked fabulous as a chicken.
Dressed as a lobster, I think.
Yeah. Oh, it's a brilliant film. Hugh Grant,
says also
Hugh Grant doing the boogie up the stairs when he takes on the American president.
Absolutely.
Showstopper. Yeah.
Can I just mention quickly my favourite movie? I have talked about this before on the podcast. For Christmas is the original Miracle on 34th Street, not starring the amazingly wonderful Margaret O'Brien, although she could have been cast a few years earlier in the children's role. That went to Natalie Wood as a young girl. This is the 1947 version starring Maureen O'Hara, John Rain, Natalie Wood, and the wonderful Edmund Gwynn, who actually won the Supporting Actor Oscar that year because of his role as Kris Kringle. And we all kind of know the story, but it is really the most perfect one because I loved the fact in 1947 the director portrayed, and she did herself, Maureen O'Hara as a single mother who was quite ambitious and doing well at Macy's. I think she was in charge of events, but looking for a promotion. And they give her the Christmas parade to do. And she's a cynic and she's trying to bring up her daughter as somebody who does not believe in fairies and certainly does not believe in Father Christmas. And then, of course, Kris Kringle comes into their lives. It's magical. So for the true believers and the not-so-true believers, that's my Christmas tip.
So if you line up Love Actually, the trolley song, Meet Me in St. Louis, Adrian Miracle on 34th Street. And the film of The Grinch That Stole Christmas isn't bad. But
No,
Mum's right, The Railway Children is just such a wonderful film. And it just, Jenny Agutter came of age. That was her first big starring role, wasn't it, Mum?
Yes.
And you fell in love with her.
Given the way the world is, I think we should bring out our DVD sets of The West Wing to see what a Liberal president can actually be in reality.
I agree with that, Slats. I thought that the other night. Just bring back Martin Sheen as the president.
Well, let me tell you Martin Sheen's story. On one of the junkets that we had to the island for the international rules, I was walking through Galway with Andrew Demetrio and my daughter, and it was about 9 o'clock at night, quite dark, and this little fellow had come towards us, and we were all about to say, "Hello, Mr. President." And it was Martin Sheen, who was at the university in Galway doing a postgraduate course. So there he was. He's about that tall.
Amazing.
Amazing.
You were about to say hello, Mr. President, of all people.
Potties out there in the open air, if it starts to rain and you're worried about your blow wave, just come in here. We can all fit in here. It'll be fine.
Now, we're going to quickly do a few recipes, Jeff. I brought out, this is still one of my favourite cookbooks. Not only because I wrote the foreword to it.
Yeah, of course.
And who's the handsome man on the front?
Jeff,
1970s porn star, I reckon.
Jeff has gone through many love affairs, but when early in our relationship, when Jeff was my sports editor, his great love affair was with the microwave. Correct. Remember the microwave gourmet? I think you even gave that to me as a wedding present.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the microwave. It's the apprentice in the kitchen that you never have.
Now,
And Julia will know that you can cook great jam in the microwave that's not cloudy.
This, and we'll put it in our show notes. It's not really, well, it's sort of comfort food, but I've never made baba ganoush any other way. You basically chuck two eggplants into the microwave and zap them, and then once they're cool and you take them out, you basically peel them and you chuck them into your Maggi mix or whatever mixer you have.
Or Thermomix.
You're a thermo... That's your new crush, isn't it? You love Thermomix. Far too complicated for me. You basically chuck it in with garlic, tahini, juice of one lemon, salt, half a chilli. Remember that period when every one of your recipes had half a chilli in it?
Now they're one.
Actually, it says half to one here. Handful of parsley and first quality virgin olive oil. Showing your age there, doll. Anyway...
Hello, Mr. Cobram.
It is the most wonderful recipe for baba ganoush.
It could be a JLT too, and it does involve the M word, moist. It's a recipe for brining your turkey so it's moist on the day, which is an age-old problem. Do you want me to read the whole recipe?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Look, they're all taking notes out.
Seriously, you think brining turkey, what the hell? Do it, you will never look back.
There's something awful about the word brine, though.
I know, but you have to get over it. I have mastered the buzzard. It really works. I've done it twice. It's really good. Just get on the show notes and do this. 8 litres of water, 3 cups apple cider vinegar, 2 cups brown sugar, 1 cup salt. 3 tablespoons peppercorns.
1 cup salt.
Yes, it's a brine. That's what brine is. You're sort of pickling.
You know, the briny.
Yes. 5 bay leaves, 5 cloves of garlic. I've lost the place now. 4 sprigs of rosemary, leaves stripped off. The peel of 3 oranges and your turkey. So it's really easy. You combine all the ingredients in the pot with the water, bring it to the boil and... whoosh it round and then let it cool. Then you...
That's where you've got to do it early because it takes a while to cool.
Yes, I'm...
Well, you gave it to me last year.
I know. Well, you rang up desperate, SOS, give me your brining recipe. Then you allow it to cool and then you place the vat in the fridge. Then you get your turkey that you've taken out of the horrible plastic, wash all that off, and put the uncooked turkey in the chilled brine solution and you refrigerate for 16 to 24 hours. Even overnight's fine. Like, just give it a go. It doesn't have to be a whole day. Then, on Christmas Day, apart from drinking champagne and opening great presents, remove the bird from the brine and then put that just in another pot for 15 minutes of cold water just to remove the excess salt, Corrie, from that cup of salt. Then you pat it dry with the paper, you pat the bird dry with a paper towel, and you cook according to your normal roasting method. And it's really good. It's a really beautiful moist turkey.
Oh, I just, you know, bring back the word moist.
I hate the word moist, but you know, nothing worse than the dry bird. Awful.
Anything you want to throw in, Jeff?
Anything I want to throw in?
Yeah, add to the mix.
I just want to, I'm reminded of that book, Simple Flavours. In the front of that book, I think I wrote 10 or 12 things that one should do to learn to cook. And one of the things is that if you can make a great sandwich, you can work out how to cook. And what I was reminded of that because those sandwiches had everything that you want in a sandwich. And the most important part of it was the bread was soft, which didn't mean you broke your teeth on the bread. Mm. The bread had flavour. The chicken was perfect. The mayonnaise and the crunch and texture that came from the odds and ends from the, what's it called? Coleslaw. Perfect sandwich. And all those ingredients are part of what cooking is. Texture, flavour, the right ingredients.
Penny, take that back to the kitchen, will you?
Thank you.
And to do it for so many people and to do it so well was just fantastic. So all credit to them. Thank you. The other thing is, yes, I've got still a love affair with the microwave, but I've always had a love affair with the pressure cooker, and it should be on everybody's gift list for Christmas if you haven't got one. It is the
Too
greatest
dangerous.
Assistant. No. Hang on. Who am I, Caro? What's wrong with a pressure cooker?
I'm just, yeah, as Anna said, too dangerous, too stressful.
Oh, too scary, out of control.
What's dangerous about it? It's made in Germany. They're fabulous. They work.
When you open the lid and everything just flies up and hits the roof and the ding-dongy thing just goes everywhere. Well, they're foul.
How dare you? You've just said be patient with the brine. What about being patient with your pressure cooker?
Sorry.
All right, okay, so we need... Give us one pressure cooker idea.
Yesterday I cooked 2 lamb shanks in a pressure cooker. 45 minutes. The lamb was covered with half a bottle of red wine, about a quarter of a bottle of water, potatoes, pumpkin, lemongrass, garlic, ginger, celery.
Half a chilli. Half a chilli?
And one big chilli. And all you do is you bring it to pressure, turn the heat down, saving the environment as well, Caro. Let it go, and you've got not only a fabulously cooked lamb shanks, but a superb stock. No energy, no effort, and it's one of those dishes that's also in there. Whatever you cook for today, make sure you've got some for tomorrow.
What do you think, Mum? Lamb shanks with lemongrass.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
Oh, yes.
I remember first pressure cookers. I'll never go back to them. Anna's quite right.
Jewel, you don't have a recipe today, but can you just can we revisit what we talked about this time last year on the podcast, which was your feelings about seafood Christmas?
Well, I think I'm going to have another one as I'm going to Sydney with my Sydney family and they do seafood and I don't want to offend them. They might want me to stay in Melbourne, so I don't think I'll discuss that again. Thank you.
After offending everyone last year.
Okay, yes. So on to 6 quick questions. And so let's leave. Have we finished with food? Did you have one, Caro?
No. I did Slats's Babaganoush recipe. Too. You never listen to a word I say.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Corrie, sorry. You're kicking it off.
I am, and I wanted to ask Julia, is it true, Jewel, that you refuse to open Christmas gifts on Christmas Day?
Oh, I like to, you know, draw it out.
Mum, you have Christmas presents from last year still sitting.
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Mum,
no.
Come on, it takes you a while.
Yes, but the wrapping, my sisters wrap things so beautifully. My sister Button, I can't ever open her presents because they sit... on the table with the most wonderful, you know, imported ribbon and... No, I don't want to get carried away too early.
So the answer is yes. I've got one for you, Anna. You went to a Don's party on Saturday night. Corrie and I and my daughter Clementine watched it at our house.
Well, we had a mini Don's party because, of course, the television had been packed away in anticipation of the move, which is always such a good thing 7 days out from your move.
We watched Brendan and my husband Brendan. We were pretty impressed. But how was yours, Anna? And was there any bad behaviour?
No, it was actually a Donna's party. It was an all-girl affair. There was some talk about not sleeping with other people's husbands, but, you know, bad shenanigans that perhaps other people had done, certainly not us. So, no, it was fairly tame, and we did watch Brendan, but then we just got on to having some fun.
You didn't watch Caro's new crush, Anthony Green?
I didn't do ABC.
Who runs up to her, all excited. All excited. Oh, Caroline Wilson, I'm such a fan.
His computer broke down, didn't it, Mum? And he was getting very frustrated.
He spat the dummy, Anthony. Apparently.
Yes, he was.
I did hear on the rumour file that Jeff Kennett might have had a couple of scotches on Channel 7. I can't confirm or deny.
Caro, the highlight of the Channel 7 coverage was halfway through when Jeff was sitting in a panel like this,
with his jacket off.
It was just gorgeous. Yeah. Just gorgeous.
But he stayed on to the bitter end, which is more than the rest of the
happy
Liberals
end.
Did.
The happy end?
They all went home, except for dear old Jeff.
Mum, do you still watch The Queen's Message?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Where is she on? She's not free to air anymore, is she?
Yes.
She's on the ABC, Corrie. Surely
she wouldn't be on Foxtel.
She wouldn't.
She'd be streaming now.
She's on Netflix. She's on The Crown. Oh my lord.
Caro, I've got one for you. Do you theme your Christmases? And frankly, if you do, can you be bothered?
Well, I must admit, Anna. Funny you should ask. I decorated the tree last weekend because, as you know, I'm off to Tasmania for a mini break on the weekend.
Another one.
I'm surprised she could say that.
Linny, will you come and do it with me next week? She's away again.
It's laced with work, Corrie, as you know.
Oh, laced.
And you were meant to come. Now, Anna, as you know, we went to Greece together this year, courtesy of our dear friend Tanya, who organised it all. After you left, I went off. You went elsewhere, but I went to Crete, and Katie was with me, who's also here today, and we found all these decorations with the eye on it. Mm. And remember I said I found all these great eyes and that you might be getting one for Christmas?
Hoping so.
Well, I've done the tree, and sorry, I actually couldn't spare.
Oh, my God, you've reneged on the
You've got the bag with the eye.
I've got the
which
I love
pretty
the bag.
Good. You and Corrie each got one, but there's there's wooden eyes, there's China eyes, there's enamel eyes.
But, you know, my Greek stepfather, bless him, I mean, Tanya, you would know this, it's not always good luck, the Greek eye. It can often be known as the Greek evil eye.
Well, I hope
so
not,
you have to be careful where you put your eyes.
There's a lot of them on our wooden Christmas tree.
So you've completely inundated your Christmas
blue.
Theme.
It's and I do remember Kate saying at one shop, you've bought a lot of eyes, haven't you? I think that one's got too many bows on it. So, yes, I do have a theme.
Caro, can I come in with a Tasmanian story?
Yep.
I was staying at Mona one year, and as you've mentioned before, I do race greyhounds, and my greyhound trainer was down there. I was on the telephone for him. He said, where are you staying? I said, staying at Mona. He said, is that the place with the 99 fatties? And it is.
Funnily enough, I'm speaking there on Friday, but I don't think I'll tell that story. Corrie, do you have a favourite Christmas song?
Yes, I do have a favourite Christmas song, as opposed to carols, which is a different topic. My favourite Christmas song is White Christmas. Oh, Jane, you are so good. Round of applause for Miss Jane. Sorry, this was written by Irving Berlin in 1942. Oh, I'm just going to start crying. Its sales to date are 100 million copies worldwide. Accounts vary as to when and where Irving Berlin wrote this song, but the main story, the one that seems consistent, is he was sitting in a Californian hotel in 1940. It was warm, it was sunny, it was Christmas, and he was feeling nostalgic, and he penned this overnight and said to his secretary, allegedly the next day, grab your pen and take down this song. I just wrote the best song I've ever written. Heck, I just wrote the best song that anybody's ever written. So that's it. And, of course, we all loved it when it was the theme song of Holiday Inn in 1942, that wonderful movie, and then again in 1954. Bing brought it out again, and it's just such a great song. Thanks, Jane.
Another great Christmas film, Mum, Holiday Inn.
Yes.
Fred Astaire.
Yes.
And finally, Anna, yes, you have a GLT to close us off.
I do have a GLT. I just think you can never have too much cold champagne in the fridge over the silly season. Fizz is the perfect Christmas drink, and it puts the fun into function. Bang, bang.
Everybody, a big round of applause for Julia, my mum, for Jeff Slattery, and for Anna Barry, and Corrie, and the Flying Duck.
And Caro, and to Caro too.
And me, of course. And Croc Media, and of course the Flying Duck Hotel, and the Interchange Bench. It is just so lovely that you all came. It really means so much to us. We actually can't believe that we've got such a lovely, intelligent, gorgeous audience. So thank you, everyone, for coming.
I can believe it. Of course we know lovely, intelligent people. Speak for yourself.
Thank you for supporting the Breast Cancer Network Australia. I've thanked the Flying Duck and the Interchange Bench. Please come to our next fundraiser lunch, which is... Oh, are we having another one, Corrie? Apparently just before the start of the footy season. Oh. Tell your friends...
Do you all want to come? Yes!
Mum?
Just because she's busy.
Mum and Anna and I always put Richmond Carlton in our diary, and that's a Thursday night in March, but any other night we're free. Tell your friends and family, please, to subscribe to our podcast. Full details of how to keep in touch with us, of course, are in our show notes. Thank you again for coming. And, Corrie, what do we say?
Well, we're not saying it, Caro. Miss Jane is going to say it. Can I just say before she comes to the microphone...
This is her, everyone.
This is Jane Neal, everyone.
These are her flowers of the week.
And
the secret of our success, Jane Neal.
There would be no podcast without Jane and her flowers and her touches and her advice and also her singing voice, because in a former life she was a rock star.
Take it away, Jane.
Thanks, everyone.
And thank you, everyone, for coming.
Caroline Wilson, Corrie Perkin and the Don't Shoot the Messenger team. This one was written for our 50th anniversary. I thought it was momentous that we got to 50, but soon it'll be 150. So it's just called Don't Shoot the Messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger, we're kind of telling ya. There's more than just one point of view, and we'll talk it through, we'll talk it through. Join Caro and Corrie and friends, sometimes the kids, Anna from the op shop, and Julia's the best, and we'll talk it through, we'll talk it through. Don't shoot, the messenger, don't shoot, the messenger. We've covered hashtag me too. We'll see the footy season through. Keep an eye on the parlays, the latest in news, and all the things we love in book, screen and food. But don't shoot the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger.
Ha ha ha!